Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Karen Thompson Walker. She's the author of The Age of Miracles, which we had a discussion about a couple years ago. At my age, everything is a couple years ago. Her new book is The Dreamers, and the title describes perfectly what goes on in the book, which was just published last week by Random House. An epidemic, which starts very slowly but accelerates at an alarming rate, begins with a girl who falls asleep, even breathing, rosy cheeks, seemingly healthy, but asleep. The problem and the crux of this book, which has a very dreamy, no pun, quality, is one which I would not qualify as science fiction, though some have. This problem is that the girl doesn't wake up, and soon other girls in the same dormitory at the same college, and men too, also begin to fall into this sleeping beauty state. Soon, the problem becomes widespread, and there's no explanation because of this increasingly emotionally charged situation. All hell breaks loose. Fear, suspicion, paranoia erupt, much as you might expect. The dreamers dream, and their dreams are heightened to a state that is way beyond what we perceive to be a normal sleeping consciousness, if you will. What happens as the book progresses is enlightening, confusing, and, as is her wont, Karen leaves us in a state of wonder, not unlike that in her first book, and I like books that do that. And with that, welcome, Karen, and thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be back.
Okay. So I always start off with stuff other interviewers don't. So let's talk a little bit about the cover and the epigraph. The cover is dreamy, but it shows us trees in a fog. I don't know whether, did you have bedding in this cover? Was this something you really loved? Because I love the cover.
I used to work in book publishing, so I have maybe an extra sense of how maybe it's nice for the author, or it's best for the book if the author leaves stuff like the cover design up to the experts in the publishing house. Random House came up with it, but we sort of went through a few sort of similar versions, but I really love how it turned out. And I love that I hope it sort of suggests, because it is obviously about sleep and dreaming, that maybe it suggests a kind of nighttime feel, but I love that it does get the landscape in, because, you know, it's set in a sort of California, a fictionalized California, like forest town, college town in the woods. I like it, how that is reflected subtly on the cover, so I'm excited about it.
Yeah, and you know, I you probably don't remember, but I own a bookshop, and as many times as people say to me, you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes in judges a book by its cover. And when this is sitting on our front table, which it is now, there's no question that besides the reviews and word of mouth, the people will pick up this book and buy it because of the cover. And I know that from...
Oh, well, that's yeah. Great to hear.
And that's why publishers are good at doing covers, because it makes a big difference. the epigraph, which is by Jose Saramago, which is not what Miracles had as an epigraph, but I've read that Jose Saramago and blindness is part of what kind of was your muse for your first book. That's weird.
That's right, yeah. Blindness, in particular, by Jose Saramago, has just been a really important influence for me for both books, and I guess in the case of my first book, it was... in a sort of maybe broader way, it just awakened me to the possibility of fantastical or speculative fiction, you know, what you could do. That book is about a strange contagion of blindness, where everyone goes blind in a matter of weeks, and, you know, you sort of watch the consequences unfold. And so it was just an important book to me, kind of a broad way, and for sure helped inspire The Age of Miracles. But then, in a way, this next book, The Dreamers, is even more closely inspired by blindness, because it's a different, it's a contagion story, like blindness is. And it because it's this you know, it's not the flu. It's not a familiar disease. It's a kind of extraordinary and invented contagious disease. This contagion of sleep, in the same way that in blindness there was a contagion of blindness. There's something about the opportunity that he explored in blindness and that I hoped to explore in Dreamers, this opportunity to explore something beyond just illness, but this, something else about the human, the kind of mystery of the human condition. So, dreams and sleep, whereas in his book, it's partly about what it means to see and not see.
Well, like, if you're looking at the epigraph as kind of presaging the book, you know, it is that night the blind man dreamt that he was blind. So the question is, like we talked a little bit about before the show, is the idea that you dream the actual reality that you live in, and it's so like your books. It's so not ephemeral, but it's so wispy and diaphanous, if that's right. It's just like, because these kids all have this heightened REM level of sleep activity and dream activity, but without giving spoilers away or anything like that, the question is, what is that activity? And it's a question that the reader has to kind of determine on his or her own, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I didn't go into this book with a special interest in dreams. You know, I would say that the story led me into that interest. And I think because the more I thought about it, the more I thought about how dreams, even though we obviously are aware of, what's real and what's not. I mean, normally, in our normal condition, we can wake up and you're like, oh, it's just a dream, and then that might be the last time you think about whatever happened in the dream. But I liked this book because once I had the idea of a contagion of sleep, I started to think, well, what's happening in their brains while they're asleep? And so dreams became a sort of natural territory to explore. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about how dreaming is a part of human experience. So even though we consider it to be unreal, and I'm not trying to say that dreams, in our real lives reflect an alternate reality or anything like that, but it's an interesting idea to explore in fiction. That it's legitimate human experience that we spend, if we're lucky, 8 or 9 hours. in each night, and also you can never have a very clear sense of what, once you wake up, of what was going on in your mind. Even when you remember your dreams, they're usually very kind of fuzzy and hazy. And so this book gave me the opportunity to explore, sort of from the inside, especially like an unusual type of dream that seems as real as regular human experience. You know, what would it be like to experience that, and how might it change a person's life moving forward after they'd experienced that?
Well, with regard to, like, what made you think of this as a story, I know in Miracles, you were deeply affected by the tsunami in Indonesia, so that was like a seed for the book. Was there something here in this book that made you kind of think, hey, there's a story there that relates to something that happened in real life?
There wasn't one thing exactly, but I have always had an interest in contagion stories, and I think, one reason is because I'm a person just by nature sort of well acquainted with fear. When I had a chance to do a TED talk, it was about that fear and how the imagination, the interplay between fear and the imagination, and I think so that's just something that's been with me always, this kind of a wild imagination that goes in the direction of my fears. That's always with me just as a person, but also I've sort of learned to channel it to some extent into my fiction. So anyway, I'm always interested in contagion stories, real and imagined. And then another thing that I think is interesting about contagion stories and why I was interested in writing one is that they are always also about the bonds between people, because contagious disease by definition spreads through the interaction of people. And so I thought there was something interesting there. The person who lives alone in a cabin in the woods is not going to catch the disease that's spreading through humanity. And so I thought it would be interesting to kind of trace, because in a way one of my subjects sort of in both books and in all my fiction, I think, is people and relationships between people and the bonds between people. And so I like the idea that a contagion story could kind of reflect, kind of follow those lines, you know, those lines of connection between people. And then the thing that, to the extent there was a kernel, like one kernel for this story, I started writing a contagion story, but it was kind of, I hadn't really determined what the nature of the sickness was. And then I had what I, in a way, I hesitate to mention, but I did have a strange dream, which was that I couldn't wake up. That was the dream, you know, that I was trying to wake up and I couldn't wake up. And so when I finally did wake up from that dream, I sort of knew right away that should be the main symptom of this strange disease. You know, what would happen if sleep was the danger.
That's pretty cool, because that invokes fear as well. And listening to your TED talk, it's interesting how you talk about using fear as a tool. And then there's this other definition, which I've always wondered about how anger is fear turned outward. And there's so many ways you can imagine. I mean, the way Sarah is afraid, and the way Nathaniel ends up being afraid, and Sarah's father is afraid, and, you know, the young couple who have a child, he's afraid, and a lot of the book, like you say, is a response to that fear. And yeah, and then May and her unusual boyfriend, you know, they turn their fear to a positive use, right?
Right, right. And my hope is that even though the people in this book are facing such an unusual and pressing catastrophe, you know, I hope that it sort of reflects the kind of everyday fears that everyone, you know, a lot of people have. So when I was writing about, you know, what it felt like for a young father, Ben, who has he's suddenly on his own with a newborn baby in this situation, in a way, even though his situation is perhaps more frightening than the average parent on their own with a newborn, in a way, it's a lot of the same fear. It's just the basic sudden feeling of, like, I'm in charge of keeping this human alive, and am I going to be able to do it? You know, and so I like moving back and forth. I like choosing this sort of, you know, imaginative premise, but then taking the reader with me into these more ordinary realms of fear and moving back and forth between those throughout the book.
It really is fascinating, because it's like, I love swimming underwater, and, you know, when you're swimming underwater and you begin to panic, you have to come up, but you realize you could stay down. You could continue to stay down, but the panic overwhelms you, so you come up, and there's something
right
about learning how to control that kind of resonates with me in your books. And the funny thing is...
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I was looking at Wikipedia, and it says wonder, you know, it says... Miracles has a light ephemeral touch. So that's what Wikipedia says.
Oh.
but I do kind of find, I mean, I find that here as well, which brings me to the idea of people calling your book science fiction. I don't think of them as science fiction. Do you?
I mean, you know, that's like a fascinating question for me, because I don't exactly come out of the science fiction world, and so sometimes I encounter, it's always interesting, like when I meet readers who are big fans of science fiction, it's sort of some, maybe half of them, I mean half of the ones who've come across my book, then they connect with it, you know, maybe in part because they're interested in these speculative science fiction-like elements, but then there's another population of, you know, really avid science fiction readers who feel like there's not enough science in my books for it to be, I don't know, classic science fiction. So I'm happy, you know, I sort of wouldn't want to argue with anyone who, especially who's connected with the book, with how they want to categorize it or call, you know, whatever works for them is fine with me. But it is an interesting question. You know, I think some people would put it, in the science fiction category, and some wouldn't. And I mean, certainly, I guess the way I probably think about it more is it's sort of playing with some elements more often seen in classic science fiction. You know, obviously a contagious disease, a kind of p- potentially something happening that's beyond the rules of reality as we understand them. I guess the thing that I do like to try to do in my book is give it a feeling of realism. So maybe that's where I would, even though, of course, it's a leap, you know, the reader has to be willing to take a leap, I try to make it feel more real than magical, if that makes sense.
Yeah, actually, no, it doesn't make sense. Because
no.
Because that's the thing that I keep coming back to in both of the books. There is more, I'm not saying it's, maybe there is an element of magical realism. I don't know. It's just it's like there is this really light curtain between you, the reader, and the book in a really good way. And that's why, you know, it's the same as your title. It's a very dreamy quality. And I don't really know that I can give an example of another writer who has that. Who has maybe Borges, which is kind of like could be easily one of your epigraphs as well.
Yes. And was considered.
Yeah, I mean, and he's also blind, by the way. So right, so, but it's just like what I think of it. I don't think of it in a particular genre, but I do.
Yeah, right.
But if I did think about it, I don't know what I would call it. It's because one, it has that dreamlike quality throughout, as does your first book, and second, because, and this is why I think there'd be arguments at book clubs, which we have lots of book clubs, and this will be in it for sure. There'll be arguments at book clubs about whether or not the book should have been tied up at the end. And I don't like books I don't like when they're tied up at the end. I like you challenging the reader as to, hey, so why did this happen? And what exactly was this ultra excitable, without going into the aspects of it, or the life within life aspect of it, which would be a spoiler if I said it the right way. So there's things you kind of just, I don't know what happens because of that. And I'm glad I don't know what happens. I can figure it out on my own if I want
to. I think just something that connects to the ending, but also your earlier question about, you know, or what I was trying to say between magic and science fiction is, I think I want there to be a logic to the book. I want it, once I make the big leap, I want there to be, even though there can be these sort of extraordinary or even potentially supernatural events hinted at in the book, I want it to follow a certain logic, and that's an idea that really Jose Saramago has this idea, which I've mentioned a lot, but really guides this type of work for me, which is he said that he would start with a big leap, even if it's a totally outlandish leap, but then from then on, the story unfolds according to logic, and so I think that's the distinction I would make. I don't want there to be, you know, random magical events taking place. You know, I want everything that happens, even the things that stretch the rules of reality, to be sort of growing directly and on some level logically out of what's taken place before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, because even though I said it the other way when you said it before, yes, this actually could happen. And it's not a stretch to think that it could happen.
I think then that happens with endings for me is that then that desire for me for realism means that I can't completely tie it up, because, you know, in reality there's so much we don't understand. Like, we all, you know, things are not explained. We you know, our science is our best tool for trying to understand, you know, the sort of nature of the universe or the human brain, but it's still, there's these big pockets of unknowable territory, and I'm interested in writing into those, but then I'm not interested in trying to fabricate a sort of explanation, you know, or like a sense of certainty about what those mysteries are, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
But it does lead to a different kind of ending, I think.
So, you know, it's funny because I've been practicing law, or I don't practice it so much now, but I practiced law for a long time, and all contracts start with this phrase, but I didn't know it at the time. And I was asking this much older, I really respected him, great attorney. I said, how do you get going? You know, how do you start this off? And he goes, I thought that too. I couldn't figure it out. And then I just said to myself, know all men by these presents, which is how every contract begins. And he said, once I said that, I knew exactly what I had to write. And it was like, it's kind of like what you were saying. Once you start, and once you get that first sentence, it just kind of, okay, now I know where to go.
Everything follows from that first sentence. Yeah, right.
Which goes to your writing habits, which you talk about a lot, which are kind of unusual too. Tell our listeners a little bit about how you write.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it's changed some since I wrote Country Miracles, but what's the same is that I write, I just try to write a little every day. So, you know, sometimes I have a few hours in the morning to write. Sometimes it's more like, you know, half an hour, an hour. But it's important to kind of, for me to kind of dip my hands into it almost every day. And that's my, yeah, and then it's kind of a slow, kind of a slow writer, and I do my editing as I go. I mean, I also edit later, but I'm not, you know, some people can write, they sit down and try to write 10 pages at once, 20 pages at once, and then do a lot of editing later. But I like to edit my sentences as I go. So I write one sentence, you know, rewrite it 10 times, then write the next sentence. So I don't know if that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but those are sort of the things that are most key to my writing process.
Does it stay with you during the day? Does the story move within you during the day?
I mean, during my book, when I'm most connected to it, I mean, ideally, I work on it a little in the morning, and then the rest of the day, should I have a moment of kind of mind wandering, ideally my mind wanders to my book, and, you know, I get an idea about a character or a change in the plot or a solution to a problem I've been working on. I mean, that's when I'm working best, that's how it is. But, you know, of course, it's always sort of a competition with other things that are coming into my mental space throughout the rest of the day. So, yeah, I'd say on a good day it works that way. On a less good day, I walk away from it when I'm later in the morning and I don't think of it till the next morning. But as long as I feel like doing it almost every day is what feels important.
Switching gears, one of the parts of the book, and I think I can get away with this one, is about Nathaniel and his friend. And it reminded me of that movie, Awakenings, you know, the Oliver Sacks book with Robin Williams.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was like, isn't that interesting how it's so paradoxical? And I thought that was kind of cool the way you did that, because, once again, it made you wonder, why would that happen?
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was, you know, a nice way to pivot the story. I wonder.
Oh, well, okay.
I was just going to say, I wonder where that came from. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but I guess I'm always interested in trying to explore, like, what's the unexpected, you know. Sometimes, like, my first idea is not the most interesting, and so sort of arriving at something a little unexpected so that there can be a twist is when I know I've hit something. And also the book, Awakening, like the book that the movie was based on, Awakenings by Oliver Sacks, was definitely a book I read for, you know, research for this book. And before I started writing this book, I've always been a fan of Oliver Sacks' work, just the way he writes in a kind of beautiful, poetic way about, you know, scientific and neurological case studies.
Yeah, I've always loved him, and especially in these last, in the last 2 years, when he wrote Sabbath and he wrote that article for the New York Times, and he looked at his upcoming death as kind of like just a transition, you know, and mm-hmm. he handled it so well, you know, better than I could uh-huh. ever imagine handling it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of one of my heroes.
Oh, yeah.
Him mm-hmm. and Richard Feynman, another one. So the other thing is one of the reviews. No, one of the, I think it might have been an interview of you talked about uh-huh. how your writing is almost like kind of a meditation, which kind of dovetails nicely with both books in my mind.
Uh-huh. So, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it, and that's, you know, I keep trying to describe, articulate what I consider this ineffable kind of numinous quality of your books, and I can't really describe it. I don't know. It's not even a question.
Thank you. I don't know that I can.
But it's there. It's definitely there, and I can't put my finger on it, but it's definitely there, and it's like the one review said about a light touch and an ephemeral touch, and I think that's, I don't know where you get that from, but it's definitely unique. I feel it's unique.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know either. I mean, you know, it's like part of becoming a writer is just figuring out what kind of writing you can do.
I know.
It will. It's
really hard when the interviewer doesn't really ask you a question. It's hard to answer it.
I do spend a lot of time. I don't know if this is related or not related, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about the kind of sound of, and the rhythm of the sentences. Sometimes I wonder if that is like sort of, I don't know. I don't know if that's what you're talking about. But I like there to be, like in books that I read, I like there to be a kind of rhythm to it, and so I try to. Which I aspire to pull that off in my own writing.
Yeah, I mean, like when you're talking about Sarah's father, that's the real stuff. Okay, you know, you got this cellar and all the stuff in it and all that. That's really real, and it comes across like a really good short story part of it, which is about this guy, and that doesn't have that quality, and it doesn't. It doesn't have to. It shouldn't. Not necessarily at all. But then. Uh-huh. When you're writing about the rooms in which these kids are and the things that happen to them, then I think that's maybe what we're talking about. It's more poetic, which is
right.
What I think what it is, I think. So.
Oh, well, that's good. And it's true. It's true, this voice. I was hoping to, kind of establish a voice that could do both registers, you know, depending on the need of which section of the book I was working on.
Okay, well, instead of me trying to ask more silly questions or just narrating my interview, I think we'll stop it there. And I want to thank you so much for joining us again for this, the second book. And
oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and if you ever get around our area in Pennsylvania, I would love to have you come by. Or if we do, when we do have a book club, if you could maybe Skype in or something like that.
Oh, sure, I would love to. Yeah, I would really love to. So.
Okay, Karen, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We were talking with Karen Thompson Walker, whose new book, The Dreamers, is something like her first book, which we've been talking about as well, The Age of Miracles. And she had come and we had interviewed her, I said a couple years ago, it turns out it was 2012. But both of those books, you know, have gotten all kinds of acclaim, and this one certainly will get more. And as I said, I mean, they both have these dreamy qualities that you kind of get lost in. And then at the end, you're going, wait a minute, what am I supposed to think? What just happened and what will happen now? And those are my favorite kind of books because, as I've said many times on the show, they make the reader work, but work in a good sense, like almost become the second writer after the writer has said, okay, this is it. I'll hand it off to you. And it's something I really like. So I was so glad to talk to her for a second time. Geez, such a pleasure. So upcoming, Rebecca, my producer, my excellent producer, has come up with a really cool book by Sarah Selecki, which is called Radiant Shimmering Light, which is about, I don't know, you could call it a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid scheme, but it's about, and, you know, specifically it's about women who are in search of something and how they try to find it and how sometimes they're fooled and sometimes they're not and sometimes something transcendent happens to them one way or the other. At first I read it as a satire and then I said, wait a minute, it's not a satire at all. This is what happens in the real world right now. And we live in a world in which satirizing something, like, for example, Donald Trump, you can't do because he's already satirizing himself. Another one coming up is Madre Vijay, who will discuss her debut novel, which is one of the most anticipated releases of this year. It's called The Far Field. It's about India and Kashmir, and about a woman's search for someone that she thought she might have loved, and then the things that happen to her along the way, the people that treat her nicely, the people that treat her not so nicely. And you would think, okay, well, interesting story. But it's so beautifully written, and it leaves you thinking about your own life in so many different ways that it's a very special book. And then we have a bunch more coming up, but I don't know exactly who they are right now. So anyway, as always, thanks so much for joining us today to listen to Karen Thompson Walker, because I think it's both The Dreamers and The Miracles, Age of Miracles, are two really good books that I would highly recommend. The first is already in paperback, so come by the bookstore and get it. And thank you so much for joining us, as I said, and we look forward to having you back here next week on The Avid Reader.